Okay, we have a PowerPoint on the screen. Pay attention to how you're feeling right now. Do you have an aversion to PowerPoints in general, or perhaps during what is supposed to be a worshipful time? Is this new and different, off-putting? I'm pretty sure in 50 years we'll still have church, but it won't be a minister delivering a sermon while you passively sit there and absorb it. Nothing works like that anymore. But today, I'm taking advantage of it. I understand, and I would beg your indulgence. This is kind of a big topic, I realized after I had already committed to it. And I thought we would all benefit from having anchor charts to keep track of where we are. Sometimes I tell my students, hang on, somebody take care of an anchor chart, because I don't know if we'll ever find our way back. So, first, I'm going to briefly run through the questions that are begged by the title of this presentation, The Next 50, What the New Diversity Will Require of Us, and What You Use Can Do About It. My basic premise is this. You may travel the world and be exposed to the diversity of the planet's cultures, but the most important culture to understand is the one between our two ears. Can church help us with that? So, great. My first question is, I had to ask these questions. What did I mean by the new diversity? And number two, what do I mean when I suggest that Unitarian Universalism offers help to accommodate this new diversity? What does diversity have to do with the spiritual health of the congregation? Number four, what is spiritual health, and can an entity have it? Number five, what is the role of the board and leadership in providing for the spiritual health of BOOF? Number six, what is the role of the individual congregant in providing the spiritual health of BOOF? Number seven, can an individual obtain spiritual health elsewhere? Is church necessary for spiritual growth? And some of you are thinking, is church sometimes detrimental to spiritual growth? And number eight, what is unique in a church that secular institutions do not provide? Now, those are eight questions, and they could be eight sermons, but we're going to do it in one. In other words, why are you here this morning? Question number one. Next slide. Thank you. What do I mean by the new diversity? Well, just think for a moment, what has changed in the world since you've been born? What was that, Warren? And it changed everything, didn't it? Made right here in Idaho. We now have one corporation, Apple, currently valued at greater than the gross national product of Poland. On Friday, a 28-year-old became the CEO of a publicly traded company worth more than most of the world's economies, and they don't even make a product, really. But what is real, after all? NPR recently did... Back to one. We're going to stay on one so that everybody knows where I am. Okay? And I know where I am. NPR recently did a story on the 1940 census because a 72-year moratorium on private information has passed and personal data has just been released by the National Archives, and it is now possible to find out just how many toilets any particular family had in 1940. Indoor plumbing was considered a standard of the health and wealth of the nation at the time, so we surveyed it. It turns out only about 55% of households had that, what the government considered modern plumbing, hot water on demand, and flush toilets. Today, it is 99%. Also on the census of that time, those who identified as white constituted 90% of the population. We learned last week that the majority of babies born in the United States in the last month hailed from the categories of other than white. Now, I don't think you use respond to fear with this statistic, but I know that there are many in the country who do. The NPR story went on to speculate about what questions might appear in the census 72 years in the future. Now, I know I've limited this to 50 years in our forward speculation, so I fudged a little here, and I'm going to use them anyway. NPR got these questions from the University of Hawaii's Alternative Futures Program, where two graduate students under the age of 30 are speculating about their world when their grandchildren inhabit it. Here's the first one of the questions. It caught my eyes. Do you have a home or a biophysical domicile? If so, is it on Earth, the Moon, Mars, or elsewhere? 72 years from now? I don't know. Here's one I liked. What is your current sex? And here's another one. What is your permission number for drinking water? Now, that third one hints at a rather ominous future, but I imagine none of us today feel threatened by the second question, what is your current sex? And yet, I'm sure that many in the country would find the assumptions behind that question abhorrent. Good for us. We're not threatened by one aspect of the future's diversity. We can expect another type of diversity in the future. In fact, we are already experiencing. The web has broken down the firewall that once stood between information and people. Newspapers, book publishers, and other producers of media used to control content and maintain certain standards. Now everyone's a blogger. The web is an anything-goes zones, and this diversity is both freeing and frightening. It is possible to be exposed to the alien, the kooky, the worthwhile, the anomalous, the legitimate, and the bastard children. We can play chess with someone from Kathmandu, or we can listen to radical hate groups. You're all familiar with this by now, and we know that this dynamic pluralism can either lead to balkanization, where we go to the sites that validate our prejudice, or we can go to sites that crack open our hearts and we learn to feel with our struggling fellow man, maybe even to donate money. We can respond to this diversity by becoming more of an island unto ourselves, solitary, one, as in the Simon and Garfunkel song. Or we can open ourselves up to the suggestion that we are all one, as Bono writes. And thank you, William. Wasn't that beautiful? So, question number two. What do I mean when I suggest that Unitarian Universalism offers help to accommodate this new diversity? This one is simple. UUs have a history of supporting progressive change and being welcoming of multiculturalism. Just look at our children's RE program that we honored today. We are welcoming congregations for the LGBTQT communities. We are out front on gay rights. This year, our General Assembly will take on social justice issues, particularly as they impact the rights of immigrants. Rights of immigrants. We don't use the term illegal aliens because humans are not aliens and no person is illegal. One may commit an illegal act, but no one is illegal by virtue of his immigration status. We believe in the inherent right to dignity in one's person. In another nod to diversity, our churches are run by congregational polity and the democratic method because, as our children's version of the seven principles states, each person gets a vote about the things that concern them. So if we are true to our UU values and principles, then we will meet the challenges of diversity with openness, humility, and a spirit of intellectual curiosity rather than fear, suspicion, and defensiveness. We can either be like the poet himself, or we can be like his neighbor, an old stone savage armed, and whose motto is about fences. UUs are predisposed to be like the former. Question 3. What does a welcoming attitude towards diversity have to do with the spiritual health of our congregation today? Good question. When it comes to accepting the kind of diversity I just spoke of, I think we all do a pretty good job of being fearless, unthreatened people. In the abstract, we accept diversity. We respond as a fearless, unthreatened people, capable of open-heartedness. Why do I have so much trouble, then, maintaining a fearless open-heartedness when I perceive that I am being challenged or perhaps merely being checked by one of my fellow congregants with whom I share so many values? Why have some of my hardest conflicts been with the people I love here at Booth? What is it that triggers that old stone savage armed in me? Why do I feel the need behind a stone fence of my own making and lob rocks? How can I possibly overcome this need to protect my ego? Let me give you an example. The other evening I was presenting an initiative called Sermon to Service to the Worship Committee. It's an idea we in the justice outreach strands want to promote to encourage more involvement in social justice activities. You'll hear more about it soon. I was pretty invested in it. Elizabeth pointed out that my request, I think I used the word should, as in you should do this, would commit her to preaching on a specific social justice topics about 20% of the time, and she was not prepared to commit to this without deliberation. There are, after all, many, many topics of concern for our congregation, especially next year, her last year with us. She did support the number of sermons I was suggesting. Did I tell you I used the word should? But wanted our committee to also think of interesting guests we might invite to speak one or two times while she is traveling. But I was feeling tired and taken advantage of for all my volunteer work. And I felt that my initiative was not being valued. That's my trigger, by the way, not feeling valued. Others raised objections before I could fully explain myself. I got defensive. Part of it was that I did use a poor choice of words, and then I had to defend it. I hate when my writing is found lacking. It's a particular God that I worship. I got defensive, and it took a while before I could put that old stone savage away and bring out the more adult self that I think I am. I can accept any number of diverse ideas, just none that threaten my sense of self. But isn't that what we decry in those who find diversity so threatening? UUs support diversity, but our congregations are surprisingly lacking in it. How can we open ourselves to the fruits of diversity if we don't work at becoming more gracious with those who share so many of the same assumptions? How can we truly welcome diversity if we keep ourselves so small? Question 4. See, I told you there was logic. What is spiritual health, and can an entity have it? I'm arguing that spiritual health is freedom from the grip of the old stone savage. It is being able to encounter challenges to one's assumptions and worldview with equanimity, attention, curiosity, and open inquiry rather than fear. Can an entity have it? Well, corporations are people, so I guess churches can either be spiritually healthy or spiritually dysfunctional. Question 5. What is the role of the board and leadership in providing for spiritual health at Booth? The board has been focused on setting up structures and establishing policies that will provide clarity about expectations. It is our belief that the lack of clarity about expectations and responsibilities leads to confusion and finger-pointing and blame and defensiveness. Expectations for who is responsible for what, for how decisions get made in a mid-sized church, which is different, by the way, from the way you make decisions in a small church from which we have been emerging for 10 years. Expectations for how disagreements will get resolved and how information gets communicated. I know it seems like a stretch, but the vision mission process that many of you have just finished taking part in is an effort towards clarity and transparency. Come to the meeting tonight and you'll find out where we are in this process. Our beloved community has had two unfortunate misunderstandings recently, and they could have been resolved or avoided with greater clarity about decision-making and responsibility. These have been very painful. We are, as a church, learning to make decisions in a decentralized way, using a structure of governance that empowers a program ministry council to make decisions about programs and initiatives with guidelines established by the board. Jane Breckenridge, our past president, says the board defines the playground and the people play within those boundaries. In the past, those decisions would have been the purview of the minister and the board, but larger churches must spread out authority, or they stay the size of a church that can be managed by a board and a minister. About the level of membership where we are and have been for about 10 years. Hence our attention to this matter. Question number 6. Whew, got that through that board stuff. What is the role of the individual congregant in providing for the spiritual health of the congregation? The author Thomas More, in Care of the Soul, writes about pseudo-community and authentic community. Authentic community is where passionate people disagree about methods and sometimes about outcomes, but they agree to work on building and sustaining the community. They are intentional and they do not avoid hard conversations. There will be conflict in authentic community because of the depth of passion that people feel, and because we're all humans and fallible. On the other hand, pseudo-communities are like Facebook. Everybody is a friend, but nobody really cares. Okay, that gives a disservice to Facebook, but you know what I mean. Our responsibility, if we are to be true to our passions but avoid fracturing the community, is to be alert to when you feel threatened and when your old stone savage begins to get activated. Number 2, own up to the things that threaten your ego. Treat your ego like the child that it is. Hug it when it's threatened and move on. Ask forgiveness when you felt wounded and become defensive. Forgive when others have become defensive and behaved badly. By your behavior, help them grow and allow them to return with grace. Be kind. Emulate the Holy Trinity that I aspire to. The three Marys, Mary Oliver, the poet of gratitude, Mary Osterman, and Mary Schwartzman. In any situation, do email only after you've calmed down. Don't impugn others' motives. Acknowledge that when someone has a different vision, it does not invalidate your vision. They are probably not rejecting your worldview. A request for doing things differently doesn't mean they stand for this while you stand for that. Avoid overgeneralizing. Turn the other cheek. But don't be a doormat. That's pseudo-community. On the other hand, don't be a prickly cactus. Love the community more than your ideas, your ministry, or your contribution. Offer positive solutions. Thank people often. We're all volunteers. We get paid with the coinage of gratitude. Question 7. Can an individual obtain spiritual health elsewhere? Is a church necessary for spiritual growth? I know that most of these suggested behaviors and dispositions can be found in any employee manual. Well, not any, but most. Good, enlightened institutions of all kinds are aware of the whole and healthy people that whole and healthy people create successful ventures. Dysfunctional companies create unhealthy people, and vice versa. In good companies and institutions, conflict still has to be managed or resolved, and we all perform to the best of our ability out of a sense of purpose or because our paychecks depend upon it. Undoubtedly, a little of both. In good companies, we are encouraged to bring our best selves to the organization, or else. Question 8. So why are you here? What opportunities for spiritual growth exist in a church that are not provided in secular institutions? Now remember, I've defined spiritual growth as the ability to transcend one's fear-based defensiveness and to grow into a person who confronts challenges with grace, equanimity, and dignity. You may have a different definition of what constitutes spiritual. So what does a church provide, and what might it continue to provide 50 years from now? I don't know about 50 years from now. I just don't. Right now, however, I think the thing that distinguishes a church, our church, from any healthy secular organization is this. A church is deliberately intergenerational. We are a cradle-to-grave community. This means that we will bury each other. Does this not require more from each other than compliance to a policy manual? You probably won't have this intimate relationship with your co-workers. Religions grow out of the fact that we die. For all of our progressive agenda and exhortations towards decent behavior, churches exist to confront this ultimate reality. It should render us humble and wholehearted and humane. When we do the work of church, when we plan worship services or potlucks, when we teach a lesson, when we serve at the Saturday market, we are doing it with people who we cannot throw away. We can't fire each other. We can leave. We can certainly always leave. But we cannot be fired or cast out. We have made a covenant to be with each other in sickness and in health, broken and healing. Perhaps some of us, if circumstances allow, till death do us part. Where else in our society does this happen? Not even in marriage. Yes, we can leave, but we can stay and grow and build. Build our future and build a future for our children. Build better selves and better relationships, constantly vigilant in an effort to free ourselves from pettiness and defensiveness and to manifest greater love in our hearts and in the world. Here is where I've chosen to do my soul work. Thank you for putting up with me, because I'm not leaving.